Today is Friday, October 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, Hong Kong's chief executive implements a ban on face masks, garnering criticism.
So I don't see how you could relate this to a step closer to authoritarianism.
Also ahead, U.S. President Donald Trump asserts he has the authority to ask foreign governments to investigate corruption. And with less than a month before Brexit, what's next after the EU responds skeptically to Britain's latest offer? These stories and more are all coming up next. Hong Kong chief executive Carrie Lam invoked a colonial-era law that has allowed her to ban face masks. The move drew criticism, but Lam countered.
The Hong Kong SAR government is invoking and valid existing piece of legislation to make a piece of regulation. And the regulation made fully complies with the spirit and the letter in this piece of existing and valid legislation. So I don't see how you could relate this to a step closer to authoritarianism. This is a responsible act to deal with an extremely difficult situation, which I hope the world has sympathy.
Lam was speaking at a news conference and said the ban on face masks would take effect on Saturday under the emergency laws that allow authorities to make, quote, make any regulations whatsoever, end quote, in whatever they deem to be in the public interest. Now, to learn more about the ban and how those in Hong Kong are reacting to it, I spoke with reporter Justin Solomon. Justin, Chief Executive Lam made the announcement earlier today talking about this mask ban. What details about the actual specifics can you share with me?
Well, so there's something here called the Emergency Regulation Ordinance, which basically grants extensive power to the executive branch. And that is exactly what Carrie Lam and the executive branch did today. They have effectively banned all masks or face paint or anything covering a face from any unauthorized protest that is going on here. So all of these protesters that you see the photos of and videos of can now no longer cover their faces, which means they can't hide their identity and they can't protect themselves from the tear gas that the police is so liberally firing at them.
Now, is there concern among protesters that this may not only affect them in terms of their employment, because we have seen companies take action against employees who have been vocal about the protests, say, like Cathay Pacific? Are they concerned about not only their physical well-being because of the tear gas use during the protests, but also the, shall we say, the economic repercussions?
Absolutely. And you saw it today where you had all of these protesters take to the streets hours before this was even announced. And these aren't the young kids that you saw protesting weeks ago. These are people that work in banks and in various sectors of all walks of life. And they came out wearing surgical masks because they say they have the right to do so. And they have this fear if their identity is shown that yes, their employer potentially could take action. Students have the fear that their school could take action against them. And of course, there's the legal ramifications that the government could take action against them, which is why you're now seeing legal groups are coming out against this new law, saying it is illegal and that they shouldn't be, it shouldn't be enforced. So I would expect many lawsuits to come forward in the days ahead.
Can you tell us a little bit more about these legal proceedings that groups are bringing against the government? Because as you mentioned, this is a decades-old colonial-era law that grants the chief executive, you know, the power to institute special rules in times of emergency situations. So what are they saying is the basis for, you know, saying it's an illegal use of that provision?
You have the Civil Human Rights Front coming out saying that this is getting in the way of civil liberties, that everyone has the right to cover their face and that about blatantly illegal in their minds, and I believe that they will come out and file a lawsuit.
There are protests today, as you mentioned, in opposition to the mask ban. What do we know about any activities scheduled for the weekend?
There will be protests all weekend long. There were protests planned prior to this mask ban. However, I would say it's safe to bet that these protests will change a bit, and they will be concentrated on the ban itself.
Justin Solomon is in Hong Kong. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Friday evening, the city's subway train suspended service because of escalating violence in the city. U.S. President Donald Trump says he did nothing improper when asking Ukraine and China to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter, tweeting, quote, "As the President of the United States, I have an absolute right, perhaps even a duty, to investigate or have investigated corruption, and that would include asking or suggesting other countries to help us out," end quote. Federal Election Chair Ellen Weintraub has retweeted her June 13th message saying, quote, "It's illegal for any person to solicit, accept, or receive anything of value from a foreign national in connection with a U.S. election," end quote. The statement came after the House of Representatives investigators met with former U.S. Special Envoy for Ukraine, Kurt Volker. Republican Representative Jim Jordan wrote on Twitter, quote, "The facts we learned today from Ambassador Volker undercut the salacious narrative that Representative Adam Schiff is using to sell his impeachment ambitions," end quote. But later on Thursday, the House of Representatives committees holding the impeachment inquiry released a letter and portions of text messages that Volker had given them. The letter from the committee chair said, quote, "These text messages reflect serious concerns raised by a State Department official about the detrimental effects of withholding critical military assistance from Ukraine," end quote. As the House plans to meet with the Intelligence Community Inspector General today about the allegations brought forward in the whistleblower complaint, the White House is expected to formally oppose the impeachment inquiry. The AP's Matt Small has those details.
A person familiar with the matter says the Trump administration won't cooperate with a congressional impeachment investigation because it began without a House vote. This follows last night's warning from House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff.
Any effort the administration makes to obstruct our ability to get the facts on the president's effort to coerce Ukraine into helping his campaign will only add to the body of evidence on a potential article involving the obstruction of the lawful functions of Congress.
Matt Small, Washington.
Now to break down and put into context what's taking place, I spoke with Associate Professor of Political Science at Augusta University, Craig Albert. So, Craig, where I want to begin today is this notion that the president made yesterday that he has the authority to ask foreign heads of state to investigate on the basis of following up on corruption, but also that we had the chair of the Federal Elections Committee come out and remind everyone that, you know, seeking foreign assistance in an election is illegal. And I wanted to talk to you really briefly about the political difference or the nuances between what the chair is saying and what the president is saying that he's doing.
Sure. Constitutionally, there is nothing in Article 2 of the Constitution which would give, that's what establishes the executive branch, that would give the president that type of power. It's strictly illegal and is in every document by the founding framers that you have to be cautious of foreign intervention into U.S. domestic politics. So even if you have a very specific or unilateral understanding of the executive power clause, I still don't think anybody, any constitutional presidential scholars, would say that the president has the constitutional authority to seek foreign intervention into anything regarding the United States. So let's give the president the benefit of the doubt and say he's not asking them to interfere with the elections. Let's just say he thinks that corruption happened in another country and they should investigate that. I still don't see how any open reading of the Constitution where the president would have that type of power to ask a foreign government to investigate a United States citizen. Not only do I think that might be an abuse of power or extra constitutional, if not unconstitutional, it sets a terrible precedent moving forward.
If we move forward to today, what's happening on Capitol Hill, on Wednesday we saw the State Department IG go before the committees. Yesterday we had the special envoy for Ukraine go before the committees. And today we're having the actual intelligence community inspector general who vetted the whistleblower complaint, who found it credible, who found it an urgent matter, going before these committees. Impeachment is a political process. So what do you anticipate coming out of these hearings after all yesterday's went for 9.5 hours or so?
I think some of these committee meetings are set in motion by the Speaker of the House to kind of start setting the narrative to combat the presidential narrative. The president is using the bully pulpit to try to normalize this, what occurred, and try to make it seem okay and that it's not that unusual. And he's doing that mainly for his base and maybe some independent voters that he won in 2016 so that they don't think what he's doing is extra or unconstitutional. So some of these committee meetings are going to provide enough evidence or enough suspicion to move forward with a formal launching of an impeachment proceedings itself. So not just an inquiry, but the formal launching of articles of impeachment by perhaps the Judiciary Committee.
We're hearing that the White House is looking to formally oppose the current impeachment inquiry, saying that a floor vote needs to happen. What can you explain about the process of beginning the official impeachment inquiry? Is Speaker Pelosi out of line?
No, not at all. I've never read in any of the constitutional documents or the Federalist Papers where there needs to be a vote to move forward with an inquiry. It's completely up to, from what I understand, the Speaker of the House, and it just moves right to the Judiciary Committee. And the first vote and the only vote that needs to occur is in the Judiciary Committee itself, which is typically the body that handles impeachment. However, the Speaker of the House can create an ad hoc committee instead of the Judiciary Committee to investigate or to start an official impeachment process itself. Then, whichever committee is chosen, there has to be a simple majority vote within that committee on each of the articles of impeachment, which are specific charges, which if you make it similar to a criminal case, would be a particular criminal charge. So these are articles of impeachment, which are just one charge each. Each one is voted on, and a simple majority for each of those articles has to be voted upon by the committee, and then it moves to the full House, where you would have a full discussion and a full
vote.
Thank you. And again, that would be a simple majority vote. So they would vote on each article of impeachment.
Dr. Craig Albert is a professor of political science at Augusta University. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course. Glad to be here.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Some people think the universe is just a wild assortment of celestial objects, like planets, stars, and galaxies. But scientists have found evidence that the universe is actually interconnected, like an enormous spider web. Research suggests galaxies are connected to one another with filaments or streams of hot, thin, ionized gas in what scientists call the cosmic web. A team of astronomers led by the Riken Cluster for Pioneering Research has found that cosmic web filaments connecting galaxies in a large and distant protocluster are quite widespread and extend over more than 1 million parsecs, or 3 million light years. The astronomers also found that the streams of hot gas are providing fuel for the intense formation of stars and are spurring the growth of supermassive black holes within the protocluster some 12 billion light years away. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The European Union has reacted with skepticism to new proposals from Britain for a deal to leave the bloc. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson outlined the plans earlier this week, which aims to break the impasse over the future of the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, which becomes an external EU frontier after Brexit. Britain is due to leave the EU at the end of the month. Reporter Henry Ridgewell is in London and joins us to explain where the process is now. Henry, we're getting word that the European Union isn't exactly on board with what Boris Johnson has called his final and best Brexit offer. What exactly do we know about the mechanics that he is putting forward that Ireland and the EU have really, you know, kind of distanced themselves as far as accepting in whole?
Yes, there are various aspects of Boris Johnson's deal that the EU and Ireland particularly doesn't like. I think most importantly, they see them as quite simply legally unworkable. Under Boris Johnson's plans, Britain and Northern Ireland would be essentially in the single market for goods with the rest of the European Union, but it would be in the same customs union as the United Kingdom or Britain, which means that you would have to have customs checks somewhere. Customs being, of course, different rates of tariffs on single trade areas. Britain claims that could be done with very discrete checks, decentralized checks as it describes them, essentially different warehouses located close to but not on the border where goods might be sent to be checked over, just a sample of goods, not every single lorry crossing over the border. The EU says that is quite simply unworkable, and essentially it would require more border infrastructure between Ireland and Northern Ireland, and that is what everyone is trying to avoid for the simple reason that they don't want to go back to the sectarian violence came to an end in 1998 with the Good Friday Agreement. They also see problems with other aspects of it in that they think that Britain is trying to cherry-pick aspects of the European Union's single market, and they cherish that above all. They think Britain is trying to put Northern Ireland inside the single market for goods only, and they see that as cherry-picking. They see the situation really as either Britain is either in or it's out, and they have to choose.
So where do things go from here? Because Mr. Johnson continuously says that Britain's going to come out on the 31st, less than a month away, no ifs, ands, or buts, but there's that law that says that, you know, he has to ask for an extension if no deal can be reached really by the 19th.
Exactly, and that plot over that law has thickened considerably today. There is a court case going on in Scotland where opponents of Boris Johnson have taken him to court by saying that the comments he has made in Parliament recently suggest he fully intends to break that law in the coming weeks, and they want to test it before he has a chance to break it. They want to effectively preempt that decision to make it clear that if Boris Johnson does break the law, he could face personal criminal proceedings. We're waiting for the outcome of that. But the government submissions to that court case say in written on documents that Britain will actually ask for an extension if it doesn't get a deal before the 19th of October. So going against what Boris Johnson has said. Now, many journalists have put that to Boris Johnson's office today, and they have responded by saying, well, it's true, we may well ask for an extension, but we have different ways of interpreting this law, and we still intend to leave on the 31st of October. So there is suspicion growing that the office of No. 10 Downing Street, that Boris Johnson sees a loophole in that law. He's desperate to keep that threat alive because he thinks that gives him leverage against the European Union.
There's also this notion that the Prime Minister is going to seek to prorogue Parliament before an election to allow the Queen to deliver a speech, something that normally happens after an election. What can you tell us about that?
That's right. The indications are that he intends to suspend Parliament again, this time for a much shorter period, so a period of about 5 days between next week and the 14th of October, when the Queen's speech is due to be given. That's about the average length of time for the suspension of Parliament ahead of a Queen's speech. The peculiarity of this, as you suggest there, is the timing. If everybody does accept that there is an election coming, then essentially what Boris Johnson is trying to do is to get the Queen to stand up in Parliament and outline the government's policy agenda. But essentially, it would be a Conservative Party advert ahead of the election. Already, the royal family, the Buckingham Palace, is very unhappy. It's made that clear about what happened with the Supreme Court case and the prorogation of Parliament last month.
Henry Ridgewell was in London. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
An Ebola outbreak in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo is now in its 14th month. And concerns remain it could spread to nearby countries. VOA's plugged-in reporting team traveled with U.S. health officials in mid-September to the epicenter of the outbreak along the country's remote northeast border. The delegation brought hope and medicine to the region, but serious challenges remain. VOA's Mil Arcega was on the trip and reports from the DRC.
It's a journey few Westerners will make, over rainforests and active volcanoes, past the winding, dusty roads leading to the remote village of Butembo. Here, elbow bumps replace handshakes. Shoes and hands are disinfected. Anyone who enters, check for fever. This is U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar's first visit to the Ebola Treatment Center in Butembo, the front line in the battle to stop the deadly virus.
It's an incredibly tragic situation, especially to see the children. So many children. I think that probably was one of the things that struck me the most, were how many kids are here. But I also came away with more hope than I thought I would.
The outbreak began last year. It's now the second worst ever. More than 3,000 people infected, more than 2,000 dead. But there is hope for a cure. The development of two new drugs synthesized from the blood of an Ebola-resistant patient.
You know, it's a game changer.
Dr. Anthony Fauci was part of the team that helped develop the new drugs. Not a cure exactly, but extremely effective.
When you say a cure, it's almost as if everybody who gets it is now going to be okay. There are still going to be people who come in so advanced that no drug is going to help them. But clearly, if you get one or the other of these two drugs, you dramatically diminish the mortality of Ebola.
But cultural mistrust is common here. Some believe Ebola is not a virus, but a man-made poison.
The misguided perception of Ebola treatment centers in the past has been that sick people would walk into these centers, and they would ultimately leave either in a body bag or in a coffin. But there's a lot of people in this community working hard to change that perception.
Among them, Mulyanza Huguette. The young woman made a full recovery after receiving the experimental drug monoclonal antibody 114. Today, she goes from village to village, urging families to seek early treatment. Another serious challenge is security. More than 100 warring factions vie for dominance along the porous eastern borders of the Congo. In this part of the world, protecting health workers is a full-time job.
Thousands of, you know, security incidents, and anytime you have disruption, you know, intervention, of course, the virus will replicate, and you have to catch up. So it's taking a lot of energy and time.
The United States has already invested over $300 million to develop anti-Ebola vaccines and treatments. Secretary Azar hopes his visit demonstrates America's commitment to the region.
If it helps reinforce the fact that we were in this before the first Ebola case, and we're going to be there after the last Ebola case, and it's a part of a community effort and community engagement, well, then I'm delighted if it had any impact.
Mil Arcega, VOA News in Butembo, DRC.
This weekend, Mil joins host Kim Lewis on Press Conference USA to discuss the outbreak with Professor Lawrence Gostin, director of the World Health Organization's Collaborating Center on National and Global Health Laws. Iraqi security forces opened fire on anti-government protesters gathering in Baghdad Friday for a fourth day of demonstrations against unemployment, poor public services, and corruption. An AFP reporter states the security forces directly fired at protesters and not in the air. At least 53 people have been killed in protests since Tuesday, and hundreds of others have been wounded. The International Committee of the Red Cross issued a statement Friday saying the deaths of civilians and the growing number of wounded at the ongoing protests across the country is particularly worrying, as is the use of firearms for restoring public order. And that'll do it for us today and this week. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Dan Brown, engineer Sidrak Franklin, and managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, thank you so much for listening. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great weekend.